were here last week, we talked about some kings of Israel, and I described the portion of scripture we were going to in a particularly ugly way. Do you remember what I said?
Excising a cancer.
No? Like we're going through a swamp. I even used a harsher word than marsh. Wetlands is what you call it these days, and somehow you can sell it for more money. Who were the kings in this particular section of scripture?
Remember any of them? 1 Kings 19, God gave Elijah a charge. It turned out that Elisha did a couple of tasks that were supposed to be done. Supposed to appoint Jehu. King of Israel was supposed to appoint Hazael. Only Hazael was king of Aram. How did Hazael become king of Aram?
Murdered the previous king. Elisha came all the way to Damascus. The previous king, remember the previous king's name? Benny, we were calling him, Ben-Hadad. Remember him? Laying out on a sick bed, he says, well, I've heard the man of God is here asking if I'm going to recover. So Hazael goes to him, and Elisha looks at him and says, you can tell him he's going to recover, but I'm here to anoint you king. There's only one way to become king. And then he wept, if you remember, because he said, why are you weeping, Hazael said, because I see what you're going to do to the people of Israel and the people of Judah. But he anointed him anyway. So Hazael was king. Who else? There was a guy named Joram, which also is sometimes written as Jehoram. Who else? We're actually going to review this one, that Joash, which would also be called sometimes Jehoash. This little throw in an E-H right after the J when you've got this kind of construction. I have no idea why they're doing that, but different translations will jump back and forth. It's really the same person. And there's actually a Joash who's in Israel. There's a Joash in Judah by the time you get through. There's several of these where you get the same names. They remember they were intermarrying at one point around Ahab. Well, you got these guys on here. And I'm sitting there last week saying, this is a swamp we're going through because they're killing each other. They're killing all kinds of people. They're having wars they shouldn't be having. It's just awful. It's like a swamp, I said. Then I got home, and I started doing some probing around. And I don't really remember why. Something caught my attention. I started chasing it. And I stumbled across some things, and I put three or four PDF files onto the lesson site. You can go look these up if you want to. One is an article from National Geographic magazine, and two are articles out of a somewhat Bible-sided view of archaeology. So, here's what those articles say. For maybe 100 years ago, until about 60 years ago, archaeologists looked at the Bible and then looked at what they were finding in digs in the Middle East. And they were lining up what they saw. And about 60 years ago, 50 years ago, a new group of archaeologists came in and said, wait a minute, you're doing circular logic. You're looking at the Bible, say this is what we ought to find, and whatever you find, you just line it up with that. And if we just throw out the Bible as a touchstone at all, just take it completely out of the picture and then try to line things up, it's clear the Bible doesn't mean a thing. If David existed, he lived in a mud village and had no more power than maybe some warlord in the Middle East might have today. He wasn't a great king, no big palaces, all this stuff they're talking about is just false. And they say, and the reason we say this is, you look in the archaeological record, there's no mention of David. There's no mention of Solomon. There's no evidence of the kinds of things the Bible said we ought to find. None of that's there. And it stayed that way for a long time. And still, in some corners, still that way today. But starting in the early 1990s, archaeology began to disclose some things. And what they're disclosing is changing that picture. The National Geographic article is especially interesting. They've got a professor of archaeology, and her student is leading a student group around Jerusalem, telling them, well, I'll tell you David had a palace here, but it's not really so. and she breaks into the group and corrects him. And it's her student, and they have these sort of battles out there. Very fascinating to read. What came in the early 90s, according to these reports, were these kings. They started seeing some things that they found that recorded in the right order, in the right place, in the right way. They have an image that they think tells you what Haziel looks like. There would not have been images of the Jewish kings because they wouldn't have let images be made of them. But Haziel, there's an image of what he probably looked like because it's a statue of him. They have reports of Jehu. They have reports of Jehoram or Joram. They have reports of Joash or Jehoash. And at least the ones that were in Judah, they say House of David. And it's the first time they've seen those links to David. Now, there's other archaeological stuff at other places. National Geographic talks about this, where they said there never was a Goliath, there never was this. Those things are starting to fall into place. All the stuff that needed to be to fit with. And it wasn't that people were looking for it, just suddenly realized what they had. And as they found these things, they began to go back and reevaluate older stuff they had and realize some of the clues were there, but they've been studiously ignored for years. So, it was still a swamp last week. It's still a swamp now. But it's a little more important than I thought. These become some of the anchor points for some independent validation of the reliability of what the Bible record shows. Okay? Number two. I would like to start with 2 Kings 13. I would like to start with 2 Kings 13, but I can't. Because if we're going to go to 2 Kings 13, we got to get a running start on 2 Kings 12. We looked at 2 Kings 12 last week, but I want to just make sure that I do a real quick review. Let me start with the point that gave the first hour the most trouble. Tell me in chapter 12, the last two or three verses, what does it tell you about Joash or Jehoash? It says up at the first of chapter 12, verse 1, he was 7 years old when he came to the throne. That's part of what we have to review. But now, come down to the last three verses of chapter 12. What does it tell you about Joash or Jehoash?
He was assassinated.
He died. So far, okay? He was buried. And his son Amaziah succeeded him. Everybody okay? Okay, hold that there for just a second. Would you come over to chapter 14, verse 1? What do you see? First hour didn't like this very much. They were having to think too hard, but you guys are I think, more able to do this. Chapter 14, verse 1, what happens? Amaziah becomes king, and we start to talk about Amaziah. So far, okay? Okay, so Joash dies. The end of chapter 12. Amaziah succeeds him, but the time that we're going to talk about Amaziah succeeding him is all the way over to chapter 14, verse 1. We okay? All right, take a look at chapter 13, verse 1. Now, chapter 12, last two verses, Joash is dead. Chapter 13, verse 1, what does it say? In the 23rd year of Joash, king of Judah, Jehoahaz, son of Jehu, becomes king of Israel. We're going to talk about that. Now, how long did Joash reign? 40 years. So we're now at a point that's 23 years into his reign. He's still got 17 years to go. He died in chapter 12, the end of it, and chapter 13, he's still got 17 years to go. Now, that's going to bother you if you have a Western point of view. You'd like your stories to say this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And what they're doing is they're saying this happened. And this also happened, and he said it there, and this also happened, and that becomes hard. And one of the things that you'll read, if you read those PDF files that I put online, is that you'll find one of the big critics of the Bible record is the numbers don't work. They tell you this one rained for this long, and then this one rained with it, and it was there. Well, it turns out there's a very interesting problem. It's also very, very obvious. When we studied David, toward the end of his life, one of his sons claimed the throne and crowned himself king. Word of this by Bathsheba and Nathan came to David, and they, probably palace intrigue, told David, "Didn't you say Solomon was supposed to be king after you? What's this other son of yours doing here?" And he, Solomon is supposed to be. And he had Solomon crowned king. And the other guy runs for his life and ends up dying a little bit later. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Was David dead when Solomon became king? No, because David made him king. I just need you to pause and think about this for a minute. It is not parallel. It is not at all parallel, but it's close enough to pay some attention to it. When do you get a new pope? When the old pope dies.
Usually.
What just happened? Yeah. He's basically still a pope, because when he's anointed pope, he's pope forever. That's the way the Catholic Church works, right? But we've got a pope who isn't the pope, and the pope who used to be the pope is still around. Okay, as I say, it's not different, but it's got a little bit of parallel to it. Here's what happened. Solomon became king while David was still alive, and they ruled together. David wasn't able to do much, so Solomon did almost all of it, but there was still some authority in David. That's called a co-regency. Regency having to do with kings. A co-regency. And this was not uncommon across this time. And what happened is, you can either count the reign of Solomon from the day that he was appointed, or you can count it from the day that David died and he became the sole king. Everybody hear that? You can count the end of his reign at the time the next king was anointed, or you can count it at the time he died. Can you feel the gears fluctuating a little bit? Well, here's what some of these guys are now saying. When you go back in the records, you find the clues that tell you the northern kingdom did it one way and the southern kingdom did it the other way most of the time, except when they didn't. And all of a sudden, these things that people have been, well, the Bible can't be true. They can't even keep the numbers straight. Well, it's because one of them was, it starts when he's co-regent, not when he's king by himself. So I'm trying to give you this little background to help with some of this, because I think it makes for very interesting reading. And suddenly these guys become much, much more important, because they're the first touchstones we've had that really give you a solid foundation for saying, you know, I think the Bible record is lining up. They've been saying, well, it doesn't line up, it's hundreds of years off. And all of a sudden the finds that are coming and the reinterpretation of things that were before are really putting this in a different light. So,
critics will take one thing.
The value of high,
we covered that, remember, with the nation.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll use one and just write off the
entire line. And that's what's so interesting, especially in the National Geographic magazine article. It talks about some of the controversy that's out there. And I just wanted to orient you to that. So now, here's what I'm saying. We're going to talk about Joash, and you're going to see essentially a series of vignettes. And they all overlap, but they don't line up. This one is not over when this one comes. It sometimes backs up and sometimes jumps forward. And I've shown you a couple of these today. All right. Our goal is to get to 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 1, where the big story of Amaziah starts. That's our goal. So our goal is to get through 2 Kings 13. But I need to back up a little bit to 12 to sort of see how this works. So let's see if you remember from last time the history of Joash, or Jehoash, depending on how he's called. My translation in chapter 1 of 2 Kings 12 calls him Jehoash. And then when you come down to chapter 13, verse 1, it calls him Joash. So it's even in my translation, it's going back and forth between those two ways of talking about him. How old was he when he came to the throne? Chapter 12, verse 1. 7 years old. What was his history up to that point? Well, let me move you quickly through it. At the age of 1, his father was killed in a battle. At the age of 1, his father was killed in a battle. His father was killed in a battle with Jehu. Jehu was anointed. He and Hazael ended up taking a whole bunch of people off the map. This kid's grandmother, the mother of Hazael, the king who had just been killed, she looks around and says, there's almost nobody left with a claim to the throne, and she kills every one of them who had a claim to the throne and makes herself queen. Except this one son of his, 1 year old, was hidden away in the nurse's quarters and then moved to, some of you remember, I hope you do, this is your turn, where was he moved? He was moved into the temple and he lived there for six years. So now he's 7 years old. He was in the temple. The head priest in the temple was the husband of the woman who had rescued him just before the queen's people came through to kill him. He's 1 year old. Where can he go? He can't run. He doesn't know to run. So the head priest is the one who's really protecting him. The wife of the head priest spirited him out and got him there, and he'd hidden there for 6 years. That priest then led essentially a regime change. The queen was killed, things were put right, and the little boy comes back to the throne. And it says a powerful thing in verse 2. It may be verse 3 in your translation. Mine says, all his life, Joash did what the Lord regarded as right, having been instructed by Jehoiada the priest. But your translation should read differently from that. I'm hoping it does. What does it say? As long as Jehoiada lived. And that turns out,
as long as he instructed him.
Yeah, and if you come to 2 Chronicles 24, this is where the parallel is. If you come to 2 Chronicles 24, starts out the same way. Joash was 7 years old when he came to the throne, reigned for 40 years in Jerusalem. And there, it's in my translation, it's finally clear. In your translation, it was clear all along, I think. Joash did what the Lord regards as right throughout the lifetime of Jehoiada the priest. The priest was even a matchmaker, got him two wives and helped him get his sons and daughters, all these kinds of things the priest was doing. Okay? Now, when you get to the end of Jehoiada's life, that's the priest, something happens. I'm back in 2 Kings, and it says that toward the end of his life, the king of Aram attacked and all kinds of terrible things happened. It doesn't really explain what's going on there functionally, but if you come back to 2 Chronicles 24, I hope you're able to flip back and forth between those now, you get a clue to this. Chapter 17 of 2 Chronicles 24. After Jehoiada died, what happened? Second Chronicles 24:17. Jehoiada is the priest who has hidden him and has put him back on the throne. All these years have gone by and he's been following this priest's advice and everything. Yeah, but why did he turn? Why did he turn? The officials of Judah came to pay court to the king. The king listened to their advice, and they, my translation has a verb. My verb is abandoned the temple of the Lord. They abandoned the God of their ancestors and instead worshipped poles and idols. Okay? If you read a few verses later, verse 20, the Spirit of the Lord, my translation says, invested Zechariah. Who's Zechariah? He's the son of that priest. The priest who had rescued him, had protected him, had put him on the throne, and had guided him all these years. He's the son of that priest. The Spirit of the Lord came on him. He stood up in front of the people and he said, God says this, why transgress the Lord's commands to your certain ruin? If you abandon, there's that word again, the Lord, he will abandon you. If you go to Romans chapter 1, verse 24, verse 26, verse 28, Paul is giving you a list of the things that people seem to fall into, and he says, you know, people who do those things, God abandons them. God abandons them. Other translations use the phrase, gives them over. Gives them over.
Is that Romans what?
Romans 1, and it's three times it said, God abandoned them in my translation. It's Aramaic or Greek over there, it's Hebrew here. But it seems like it's the same word. God gave them over, I think King James says. God abandoned them. I'm back in 2 Chronicles 24, verse 18. They abandoned the temple of the Lord, the God of their ancestors. Verse 20, Zechariah is speaking. If you abandon the Lord, he'll abandon you. And what happens? The king sets out and has him murdered. And then verse 23 comes. Here comes the army from Aram. Back in 2 Kings, it looks like, well, they just showed up and attacked. Over in 2 Chronicles, it says, there's a little bit more detail to it. What's the detail? Verse 24, although the invading Aramaic army was only a small force, God allowed them to defeat a very large army because they had abandoned, there's that word again, the Lord, the God of their ancestors. And in this way, they executed judgment on Joash. Everybody still okay? Hold your place there. Let's go back to 2 Kings 13. We can now look a little bit at 2 Kings 13. Look at verse 3, because now we're going to look at the nuance that comes in the version in 2 Kings. This was causing the people in the first hour a little bit of problem, because this flipping back and forth and looking at different versions of the same thing was causing the problem. I'm hoping that's a little better for you, but maybe not. But here it is, 2 Kings, looking at the same things. Watch what they do. Verse 3, this aroused the Lord's anger. He delivered them without respite into the power of Hazael, king of Aram. Right? So you got one of these is going on in Judah, and one of these is going on in Israel. Same kind of things happening. God's bringing judgment on these people. So back in 2 Kings 12, 18, you've got Hazael, king of Aram, coming to war. And what you find in 2 Kings 24 is part of that war was because they were avenging for God. And it's going to happen to Israel, 2 Kings 13, when we get into that, it's going to happen to Israel as well. God is using Hazael. That's what Elisha saw, and Elisha wept when he saw it. He's using Hazael to bring judgment, and that's awful and that's tough. Okay? Now, here's the thing I want you to look at. Look again at verse 23. 2 Chronicles 24. Thank you, thank you. 2 Chronicles 24. We looked at verse 24, which was, it was a very small force that the Aram sent, but God gave them success, right? Backing up one verse to 23. The Aramaean army made war on Joash. When they reached Jerusalem and Judah, what did they do? Yours says the leaders of the people. Go back up for just a minute to verse 17. Mine says, after Jehoiada's death, the officials of Judah came to pay court to the king, and the king listened to their advice, and everything went off the rails, right? Mm-hmm. Down here, the Aramaean army comes in. This is verse 23. Who did they kill?
Mine says officials of the people.
Mine says the officials of the nation. Mm-hmm. Here's my question. Is that the same group? If God's bringing judgment, the first group he might bring judgment on are the ones who gave the bad advice, who gave the advice to abandon God and move in other ways. I find something interesting in there. I'm still in 2 Chronicles 24, verse 25. After they had retired, they left him seriously wounded. His own retainers plotted against him. Why did they plot against him? For murdering Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada. They murdered him in his bed. When he died, he was buried in the city of David, but not in the kings of, in the tombs of the king. Did I see that? He wasn't given a particularly good burial. And then if you take a look a little bit further, last few words of chapter 24 of 2 Chronicles, what does it say? His son Amaziah succeeded him. Chapter 25, Amaziah was 25 years old when he came to the throne. Okay, that's our goal for today, is to get to that spot. So we've reached that in 2 Chronicles. Right? So now we're going to go back to 2 Kings and see if we can get to that same place. Where's that place? It's chapter 14, verse 1. So we're back now in chapter 13. We've got the story of Joash in chapter 12. We're now starting to look at chapter 13. And chapter 13 switches the focus from Judah to Israel. This isn't going to happen much longer. Pretty soon, the focus of the history, both 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, is going to be not completely, but almost completely, focused on Judah, the southern kingdom. The focus on the northern kingdom is about to end, or at least about to come to where it's almost done. And I want you to have a sense of one way to look at this. And we're going to look at this in just a moment. We're going to see if we can see this spot. But you almost get the sense of God watching these two nations, both having emerged from David's kingdom. And he's looking for, is there anybody who's figured out their only hope is in me? And if there is, like somebody trying to start a fire, you bring a little bit of breath to it, a little bit of attention to it, try to get that fire to grow. And it's sort of like in this swamp that we're in. You get these moments where somebody seems to figure it out. And the tragedy is, in the Northern Kingdom, it never stays. It never gets very big. That's what you're seeing. That's the big picture. So let's go into this in chapter 13. 23rd year of Joash, Jehoahaz, son of Jehu, becomes king of Israel in Samaria. What's the judgment in verse 2? How'd he do?
Evil in the eyes of the Lord.
Gets a pretty bad report card. Everybody see that? He gets a pretty bad report card. 1 second, let me put this back. There we go. He gets a pretty bad report card. And verse 3 tells you what the consequence is. What's the consequence? God aroused, God's anger was aroused against the Israelites, and he delivered them without respite, mine says. Does yours have something like that?
For a long time,
yours says. Continually, yours says. Into the power of?
Haziel.
And?
And in the hands of Benny.
And in the hands of Benny? Who's Benny?
His son.
Whoa. Don't let that trip past you so quickly. How did Haziel become king? He murdered the previous king, whose name was? You just reviewed it. Ben-Hadad. Haziel's son is named? Ben-Hadad. Now, I did not offer an explanation this first hour because we're running a little tight on time, and we may be running slow on time here, but I'm going to offer you an explanation anyway. How old was Ben-Hadad, the son, and how long had Ben-Hadad, the king, been dead? I got a feeling this kid was named while Ben-Hadad was still king to maybe curry favor with the king. And now the old king's dead, and the poor kid is still saddled with the name of the man his daddy murdered to become king himself. I really worry for this kid. I think he's got some pretty challenging issues. But anyway, here he is. Okay? That was verse 3, right? God's anger, that's the consequence. God's anger comes. Verse 4, what does Jehoahaz do?
Talk to the Lord.
He talks to the Lord. How long has it been since somebody talked to the Lord? There's a whole bunch of people, Jehu included, that the Lord has talked to them. Jehu didn't go seeking the Lord. God's prophet sought him out. Right? Haziel didn't go speaking to the Lord. Elisha came all the way to Damascus to talk to him. Right? This is the first person for a long time who started to pray. And it seems humble. It seems to be in spirit with those. And what's God's immediate response? He listens. And what does he provide? I believe I'm at verse 5. He furnishes a deliverer. Who is that? It doesn't say. And even more importantly, it is not immediate deliverance. The way you read verse 5, you think, oh, everything is now going to be rosy. Read verse 7.
He's kept on doing.
Read verse 7. What does Haziel do to the forces of Jehoahaz, the forces of Israel, the northern kingdom? What does he do? That last phrase, what's that last phrase? Grinds them into the dust of the ground. You sort of put your foot down and you twist it like this. Right? Everybody see that? There's a deliverer that's been provided, but the deliverer hasn't done his work yet. So we're still watching for who that deliverer is. It's not going to be Jehoahaz, and it's not going to be right then. Everybody still okay?
Thank you. I
gotta
go get Rachel.
Okay. Okay. What does the word decimate mean? It does not mean destroy. Yes, sir. Santa Ana in Mexico, you line up the opposing soldiers and you shoot every tenth one. The army of Israel, we think, was maybe 300,000. If they had decimated that, how many would have been left? Math quiz time. Those who are math phobic, cram and hide. 270,000 would be left, because only 30,000, one-tenth, would be gone. How many are left? 10,000 out of 300,000. What has happened? This ain't decimation. What's this? This is annihilation. What's the phrase? Ground into the dust. I want to make sure you see that.
It's like at the threshing floor.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
Yeah. Just grind into the dust. Verse 10, in the 37th year of Jehoash, king of Judah, Jehoash, son of Jehoahaz, became king of Israel. And now we got two Joashes or two Jehoashes, and maybe we keep them separated by letting one be Joash and one be Jehoash. But everybody see what I just said? Verse 10, chapter 13, 2 Kings, the name of the king of Judah and the name of the king of Israel are suddenly the same. The one who ascends to the throne in place of Jehoahaz has the same name. The only difference would be one of them might be Jehoash and one might be Joash and one might be Jehoash. Almost the same name. Why do they have the same names? Because of all the intermarriage that took place between the house of Israel under Ahab and the house of Judah under a couple of those kings back there. Remember all that? Doesn't do much more than simply say in verse 11, he doesn't get a very good report card. And you move on, verse 14. Jehoash died back at the end of chapter 12, but Jehoash is still here, except it's the Joash who's in Israel, not the Joash who's in Judah. So this one, verse 14, Joash, king of Judah, comes where? Where does he go? Verse 14, 2 Kings 13. Where does Joash, this is king of Israel, where does he go? Come on, guys, you can do it.
Visited Elisha.
The bedside of Elisha, and Elisha is on his deathbed. He sheds tears over Elisha and said, Father, Father, chariot of Israel and his chargers. And Elisha took bows and arrows, put a bow and arrow in his hand, drew back the bow with his own hands on the king's hands, shot it out the window to the east and said, you're going to defeat Aram at a certain place and you're going to do it completely. And then he says, take the arrows that remain, and he took them in his hand. And he says, strike the ground. I don't know if this is going to work or not, but I had some kids this week doing an experiment. First thing they did was add concentrated ammonia, as concentrated as you can get of ammonia and water, and they put it into a flask. And then the directions were, make it acidic and check with filter with pH paper to make sure that it's really acidic. And they had some acid, and they started adding the acid. And one student said to me, how much do I have to add? And the person had added three or four squirts and turned around and said, that ought to be enough. And I took her through a calculation. She had this much ammonia, all of which was basic and had to be neutralized. And she had added this much acid. How much acid does she have to add?
More.
She's got to add this much and a little bit more than that before it flips all the way over. Everybody see that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He says, strike the ground. Those were the instructions Jehoash got, or Joash got. And what does he do? He hits the ground three times and he looks up and Elisha starts to weep, or he starts to scream. I don't know which one. Oh, that you had struck the ground six times. If you had, you would have beaten Aram completely and forever. He didn't. He didn't. And somewhere in there, there's a lesson on perseverance. There's a lesson on if somebody says do something, you do it till you're told to stop. I don't know what to do with that lesson, but that's what's there. And if you read the rest of this chapter, I have to turn the page to do it. Hazael oppressed the Israelites throughout the lifetime of Jehoaz. He was kind and took pity on them. He didn't let them completely die off. And it says right at the end, even after Ben-Hadad came in, kept going, but it says Joash defeated him how many times? That's the last little bit of verse 25 of chapter 13.
Three times.
And that's the prophecy coming through. I don't know what to make of. Well, you didn't tell me I had to do that. Somewhere in the way God works with us, he tells us to start doing something and he doesn't tell us to quit, and we stop and say, well, that's enough. And I don't like that lesson I think because it hits a little too close to home, maybe. But somewhere in there, Elisha says, if you just kept going, things could have been different. There's a prophecy you could have earned or won. What happens in chapter 14, verse 1? 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 1. Amaziah becomes king. That's where we left off at chapter 25 over in 2 Chronicles. That's where we're leaving off here. And that's where we're going to stop. What are the big things we saw this week? We're still in the swamp. But we start to realize some of these kings we're reading about are the ones that are beginning to emerge from the record, from the archaeological record, independent of anybody looking at the Bible and trying to make them fit. They're there. And people are beginning to realize if I start looking at what the evidence really says, it guides me back to the Bible record's pretty good. The one thing you have to remember is co-regencies and exactly how you count the years. Don't be too bothered by it being off a little bit because it's probably just a different way of counting in one kingdom versus the other. We will come back, not next week, but the week after, and we'll pick up that spot. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we see in these words stories that seem both ancient and current. We see in our country leaders that seem not to pay a whole lot of attention to who you are, what you've said, and what you're saying today. So I pray that you would raise up leaders, but more important, I pray that you would prepare our hearts so that we can recognize the leaders that are really listening to you and not the ones who are just pretending so for some kind of gain. Bring our world back to you. Let the revival that needs to happen start here in this place and start with us. I pray that you would watch over and care for our church and the leaders that remain here as we go through the transitions that are coming. All this I pray in your Son's name. Amen. See you next week and the week after.